Kristen
and Jill, ma'am,
and we're here today for our
Squatcast.
Yay! So we're looking at Chapter 2 of Free Range Learning by
Laura Grace Weldon.
Yay! Here we are. So this chapter is very interesting, Jill, and we were talking earlier about how important this chapter was to both of us. So the topic for this chapter is called Nurturing the Learner, and it starts out by talking about trust. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really liked this chapter, obviously, because I have lots of doodles on several of the pages.
Here. And if you are listening along with us at home on this, we are on page 23. So we haven't made it very far into the book, which is okay. We're progressing along and taking little bits here to explore. Hmm. So the first thing that caught my attention with this chapter was actually close to the first sentence. It says a key factor in homeschooling is trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it. You know, they're talking about that children have the innate ability to learn and an inborn sense of how they learn best.
And it's hard sometimes to remember to trust our kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean with the cookie jar or, you know, things like that. What I'm talking about is trusting in their ability to learn.
Yeah. And their timing to know when they're there for that. I remember being very anxious about the reading readiness signals.
Mm.
Are they doing all of these things? And it really doesn't matter. They'll get there when they get there on some of those points.
Absolutely.
Doesn't matter what I put in front.
Totally. And I have to say, another sort of sentence that really stuck out in my mind here was one of the interviews that she did and recorded in the book here. And the parent says, the best part about homeschooling is that there is no failure.
And there's actually no behind either.
Yes.
I like that.
As Laura points out in her book, when kids are in school, there are benchmarks.
Yes.
And the longer a kid goes without achieving the norms, mm-hmm. then the poorer their grades, the mm-hmm. more negative the reinforcement, they're behind, they're stupid.
Well, exactly.
You know, those kinds of things, they need remediation.
Yep.
When, in fact, it's just that the child is not ready to learn the material yet.
Yep. You know, we all develop at our own paces. Girls develop physically at their own time. You know, we know where those years ranges are, but really with education, it seems like we have it really stuck in our head where it needs to be. And it's not any more true than
bosoms. Anything else. And I'm going to say, just like medicine, I think old-fashioned medicine used to say that body temperature was a specific
mm-hmm.
temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were varied on either side of that, you mm-hmm. were running a temperature or not functioning properly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think medicine has now come to understand that health is a range.
Yep.
And that there is a range of what is considered normal.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not certain education has totally gotten there yet. you know, we need to understand
mm-hmm.
that there is a range and that children within a certain set of years
mm-hmm.
will accomplish this task.
Mm-hmm.
I find it interesting, and I was going to say some of those kids who don't accomplish in what is deemed the normal time frame go on to suffer with anxiety and stress. And the things that they fret about, they now no longer are interested in trying
mm-hmm.
because it signals failure to them.
Yep.
I remember even my own sister waking up in the middle of the night with nightmares about math tests.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a very smart lady today and deals with numbers and purchasing and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, it was so incredibly stressful for her as a child.
Absolutely.
It is, I think, sometimes also when we push kids too hard to do too much,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
it actually ends up taking longer.
If we look at ourselves for that, yes, we sometimes, you know, feel the need that we need to do something on a time frame. Maybe we do. Maybe we have something we need to read ahead or we have to get done. But I know that for myself, for ones that I've had a chance to do on my own time, it sinks in much better than when I was on a time frame. Sometimes I'll take what information I need in, I can regurgitate it back within a certain amount of time, and then it's gone.
Absolutely. Did you enjoy the study that Laura shared with us that was by Lewis Benzit, superintendent of the Manchester, New Hampshire School Division?
I did.
I thought it was very interesting. I thought it was very interesting that he was able to actually experiment.
Maybe that's what we've been doing all these years.
Absolutely. In fact, today while we are recording this podcast, there's a birthday party going on
mm-hmm.
out in the creation studio.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the uncles who was here several years ago came up to me and said, Diana, I understand that you guys have had your 9th birthday. And so tell me, have you had enough students graduate now that you're able to see the results of your methodology? And I had to laugh because I'm thinking, yeah, homeschooling has been around for hundreds of thousands of years.
It was
never seen any results.
No, there's no proof. Don't we have that comic book on one of our walls somewhere, a little comic?
Yep, I think so.
Yeah.
But what was interesting about this study was the fact that this superintendent abandoned traditional arithmetic study or instruction in mathematics, and he postponed it until the kids were in grade 7. And those classrooms where he postponed it, there was still lots of learning going on and lots of math learning going on, but it was done in a natural kind of setting. So the kids learned how to tell time. They kept track of the dates. They played with toy money. They bought and sold things. They used numbers in the games that they were playing, all those kinds of things, but they were always within a broader context. And the numbers were used to make sense of things. He talks about how refreshing it was to go into those classrooms and that they had a very joyous spirit about them.
Yep. I really liked that, his various comparisons. And yeah, I can really see that.
And that's what I noticed. You have a fantastic saying, if people are crying, no one is learning. And this is so true. So if the kids are pulling their hair out over math or any other subject, they're not ready yet. They're not learning.
As the mom are crying, trying to push a subject through, and they're not there, stop, because they're not learning from you either. Anybody crying, just stop, move on, do something different.
Yep. I liked that as an example of something they were doing in the classroom. He talked about taking a reproduction of a well-known painting, hanging it in the classroom, and then asking the kids to talk about that piece of art.
Yes.
What was interesting was kids in a traditional setting using the current curriculum and all that kind of stuff were able to use approximately 40 adjectives to describe the painting.
Yeah. Nice, pretty, blue, green, cold. Yeah, very straightforward.
Standard
nice adjectives,
stuff.
But
yeah, very plain. Yeah. Whereas the kids in the experimental classrooms, on the other hand, actually used 128 kinds of adjectives, and they were much more sophisticated and advanced adjectives. Things like majestic, awe-inspiring, unique. So, again, a huge difference in just taking one aspect. So the focus of this was math, right? And delaying math curriculum and instead teaching numeracy and literacy. But what it did was expanded the children's perspective and outlook on things so that they were learning about the real world and they were listening to adults and they were experimenting with language. And that, from math to language, like, I think it's interesting that the focus was math. This was a math experiment, but yet it really translated in so many other ways.
Well, I think that's the part of the issue, and we've talked about this. When you start breaking things down into, this is your math hour, and this is your language arts hour, and this, we compartmentalize things, when really it should be a life lesson,
right?
And not a compartmentalized lesson. I mean, I get it. If you want to learn how to change a tire, you don't want to know how to fix a carburetor. But in education that you're going to use for your whole life, I think that that makes more sense.
Well, and what a meaningful time to teach a kid to change a tire when you're stranded on the side of the road and he can see why it is important to know how to change a tire.
Wait a minute. That might be the moment that someone is crying. That would be me. That's a good moment for me to be changing.
But what's interesting about the whole thing, and he concludes about his experiment, is the fact that they did some further testing where they actually took kids in grade 6 and only taught them math for half of it.
Yes.
And then they wrote math exams alongside kids in the traditional system. And here were these kids who had never had math, but only literally half a year of math. And they were able to master and do just as well, if not better, on the test than the kids who had actually taken math the whole way along.
Well, I mean, I can actually speak to that. My daughter did not do any math curriculum once she came out of school, you know, through her grade 3rd year. Really until grade 9. And then she did an overall math course And then she carried on for her high school credit ones. And, you know, my son, very much the same. He did not do a math program until grade 6. And it was a grade 7 math program, but we made it a 2-year program because it, again, reviewed all that stuff. And he's very comfortable in math. You know, actually, the reason why we gave him that math course was because he was really struggling in language arts and feeling really unsuccessful. And we knew he would be good at math. So it was good for his confidence.
It's important for parents to know their kids' strengths and weaknesses, though.
Mm-hmm.
And by sort of highlighting what a kid is good at,
mm-hmm.
they will discover all the other bits and view those bits mm-hmm. through the lens of their strength.
Yep.
And so if they can tackle something and be successful at it, then they can do those other pieces.
Yep.
And it's not a focus. They happen to be a sidebar.
Yes.
And so then they're often far more successful than if they had sat down and just looked at math.
Yeah. You will do math. Yeah. Here we are back in that struggle. High school. It's all compartmentalized.
It is, sadly. It was interesting how they were talking about in the next page there
mm-hmm.
About giving 3 groups of kids the same passage to read.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the first group of kids, they were told the emphasis was going to be on the test.
Mm-hmm.
The second group of kids, they asked some questions about.
Mm-hmm.
And the third group of kids, they asked to for them to reflect on and think about the passage they were reading.
Mm-hmm.
What they found was the kids who were pressured
mm-hmm.
and were forced to take the test
mm-hmm.
actually did less well on
yes.
the examination
mm-hmm.
than other kids, and they didn't actually retain the material. It was a very much a surface
yeah.
grasp of the material.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks later, those same kids were sort of tested again or asked about it again. And it turns out the kids that had taken the test had almost completely forgotten the material. And I have to say my own experience, it's been totally
yes.
that way.
Yeah.
You shove it in there
mm-hmm.
for the sole purpose of an exam.
Yes.
And it's a regurgitation
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a deep comprehension of the material
yeah.
for a motivation, for a motivated reason.
Mm-hmm.
I like here, the term was used, a surface imprint.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I have done that many times with things.
And it is a survival tactic in the world. It is a good tool to have, but is it really the best tool to build our children's education on?
Completely.
Know?
So that pressuring of kids,
mm-hmm.
And you and I have both seen homeschool parents who have gone to both extremes.
Yep.
We've seen ones that have been way too lax,
mm-hmm.
and they don't challenge their kids,
mm-hmm.
and they don't provide them with enough enrichment.
Yep.
We've also seen the other side of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say the other side is equally as damaging,
mm-hmm.
where parents are pressuring their children to perform better, higher, more,
yeah.
more, more.
Yeah.
And
they strive for excellence and nothing less.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure. Those kids, you know, it's a lot of pressure.
So I think our role as a homeschooling parent is to guide our children,
mm-hmm.
not necessarily to control and judge them.
Some of those parents, too, they do want the best for their kids. We all want the best we can do for
Absolutely.
Our kids. But I think also they get a little wrapped up in defending, again, their choice to homeschool, and their best defense is, but this child is excelling so far beyond their peers, they
yes.
couldn't do it. And it's their way of justifying their choice, when really the choice could be, you know what, this just works for us.
What are you doing? Are you supporting your children?
Mm-hmm.
Are you guiding them?
Mm-hmm.
Or is your homeschooling program very much about control and judgment?
Mm-hmm.
So think about it for a few minutes at home and see, you know, how you would evaluate what you're doing and how you're interacting with your kids.
And again, is the judgment on your child, or are you reacting to your perceived judgment from the world of your choice? Because
right.
they're pretty heady stuff. You know,
absolutely.
We've all felt it at moments, but have we been able to fight it down?
Yeah. And the important thing is we need to focus on the best interests of our kids. This little segment, and it says, I discovered that my youngest daughter had ADHD after a year of struggling with traditional book teaching. I also discovered that she had dyslexia. I found that although I need total and complete structure by utilizing schedules and books, that she needed something different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we don't often understand that our own style is different yet again, possibly, to that of our children.
Yep, what we're drawn to. Like I say, I don't personally like workbooks, but I like the fact that I can see where it is. But for how many years did I sell perfectly beautiful, brand new workbooks at the youth curriculum sale?
Actually, I think some of them are here at the school now, Jill.
We've used them all for years here.
So, but let's get back to the concept of trust. Yes. We need to trust in our kids. We need to trust that they're learning. And when we can find that trust, then we can relax, and suddenly the process takes a life of its own. And we're focusing on process versus content.
And the other thing about the trust is, I think sometimes we need to trust a little bit that things will work out. Mm. And, you know, even though maybe your child doesn't know what they want to do, maybe they jump around from being, I want to be a neurosurgeon to I want to be
A princess.
You know?
I don't think a plumber.
I mean, really, but that thing is, when they start on their paths, and whether that path starts at 5 years old of their interest of digging toy dinosaurs out of the yard, and you think, ooh, maybe we have a paleontologist in our midst. Well, that path may then turn to garbage trucks. You're thinking, okay, well, I'm going to have a garbage man. Maybe they really like the engines. Maybe they're going to be a heavy-duty mechanic. You know, you just don't know. You have to kind of have trust, and you don't know what's going to come into that child's path in their maturity that's going to change their direction.
Actually, Megan and I, that's my daughter, were having a discussion just yesterday about the fact she made a comment that she wants to go to law school. And she has this all planned out in her mind.
Yes, she does.
She does. And I said to her, honey, I just want you to know that your dad and I are open to other possibilities.
Yeah.
So I don't want you to be locked in because you've created this pathway, mm-hmm. and now that you've verbalized it and told the world this is what you want to do, I don't want you to be locked into that.
Exactly.
Because I look back on my own life, mm-hmm. and being a few years older than she is, and I think I could never have...
No.
Known that we would be running a school, that we would be helping other families educate,
yeah.
that I would have traveled, mm-hmm. all the things that were wonderful about my life, I had no idea about.
Yeah.
It was a total surprise.
It was. You know, it was not planned out. And I think sometimes kids worry that they've said this, they've verbalized this, or they've said it. Maybe they've said it, you know, just at home, maybe they've said it to the world, and they feel so locked into it, and they feel like they're letting people down if they make a change. And it's like, no, I mean, my daughter felt like she let everybody down big time when she changed from wanting to become a pastry chef to being a butcher.
Both are equally tasty.
I get good food. I'm happy. In fact, I have some beautiful steaks for myself for dinner tonight.
Nice. I know where you live.
But, you know, even though that's not like neurosurgeon to princess, you know, it is still in the culinary field. She felt a lot of pressure about making that change.
Mm.
And she kind of felt the need to justify it for a while to people.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, sometimes as homeschooling parents, we start out very rigidly because we don't trust the process.
Mm-hmm.
We don't trust that this is how children have been educated for thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked the quote that finished up page 27 there at the bottom. And it says, "The image of how I wanted to homeschool has changed greatly from doing school at home,
mm-hmm.
to a more fluid form of family learning."
Yes.
And, you know, that's our mission statement, is talking about families learning.
Yep.
So that each young person in mm-hmm. that family is supported and can become a lifelong learner and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But the key really is the family has to be learning.
Yep.
Learning together and enjoying what it is that they're learning.
You know, sometimes it is a matter of supporting each other in your interest. Maybe, you know, maybe your little brother is obsessed with worms, and so, you know, focuses on worms for a while. And then maybe your focus is on, I want to decorate the most beautiful cakes in the world. So that's where the focus goes for that for a while. You know, families splitting up the need within the home isn't always about making sure everyone has exactly the same allotment at all times. It
right.
has to do with whose need is greatest at that time.
And also for parents,
mm-hmm.
too. I know, for example, I'm currently taking some university courses, and I have been for many years now.
Yep.
I can only manage one at a time
mm-hmm.
over, you know, several months.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay, but I'm progressing away on things.
Mm-hmm.
It shows my children that I believe in lifelong learning.
Mm-hmm.
It shows my kids that even though I'm an old lady with very gray hair, I can still learn.
Yep.
And so can they. Yep. And that we place value on this. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is just about as important as, well, pretty much anything. It's the skill that we want our kids to have.
Yeah.
Learning takes place.
It's what you do.
Yeah, forever.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read the section at all, Jill, attachment parenting?
No, I think my visit to the parking lot was over by that point. As I read this while I waited for my son at a course, and then I sadly just haven't gotten back to it.
We hear it lots in the homeschooling community talking about attachment
mm-hmm.
parenting.
Yep.
And basically what it is that the concept of when a baby cries, you actually attend to that baby. You
yeah.
go to them, you snuggle them, you take care of their
right.
needs. And the idea behind it is that, I say this to many people, you can either pay now when they're little,
yep.
or you pay later when they're a teenager.
Yep.
And what ends up happening is now when they're looking for comforting and nurturing and support, they turn to you.
Mm-hmm.
But when they're a teenager and that pay later, they don't turn to you necessarily. They're searching for those sorts of things in the big, wide world.
Yep.
And not everybody is going to provide that support and nurturing in a very positive way.
Mm-hmm.
So I often say to parents, you can attend to that small screaming child now
mm-hmm.
and teach them now,
mm-hmm.
or you can pay later.
Yep.
Your choice.
Yep.
It turns out, science is proving, that they become wonderful, independent adults
yes, they do.
Who have a strong sense of self
mm-hmm.
and a positive outlook on the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I will never forget the meeting that I got hauled into when I pulled my daughter out of school, public school. And it was really set up to be really quite intimidating. There was the principal and two vice principal and the school psychiatrist. And
oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah. And we're hauled in there, and they had me have my daughter with me, who was 2 months into grade four. And they were going on about how I am doing her a disservice. And I had already notified them that we were going to be homeschooling. And they had hauled me in, and they'd said, this is terrible. You can't do this. She needs to learn to not be so attached to you. She needs to learn that she has to find her way. And I had said to them, no, actually, I think she needs to learn that if something's not working, try something different. And this is not working.
Sort of a lack of trust.
Yes.
That's where it was coming from, is that as professional educators, there was no trust that children would actually learn and want to learn. I think it's interesting here at the Phoenix Foundation, all of our programming is optional.
Mm-hmm.
Our teachers pick the things that they want to teach, and the kids pick the things they want to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, that is a powerful combination. When you put two groups of people together in a room who both have strong motivation, have keen interest with regards to the material,
mm-hmm.
you end up with very engaged learners.
It's quite interesting to sometimes hear our instructors bartering and working out who gets what class. Maybe two of them wanted to teach the same class, and they start negotiating. That's the word. Their negotiations go, well, you know, I signed up to do this class. You know, maybe we could switch. And yeah, the negotiation is quite amusing.
But it means that everybody does a better job.
Oh, yeah.
The instructors are doing a better job because they're invested. They know the material. They're excited about the material.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids are excited about learning.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that amounts to a much higher energy level,
mm-hmm.
a much better retention of the material,
oh, yeah.
a deeper investigation of the material, and
yep.
so on. So, like I said, fantastic way to learn.
It is.
It is interesting, though, the book is talking a little bit about parenting styles.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this was interesting, too. Talked about three kinds of parents. And I think this material has been reworked over the years for various kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But one is the authoritative parent.
Mm-hmm.
You will do it my way. And this makes me think of, sadly, some public school systems.
Mm-hmm.
You will do it my way. It's my way or the highway.
In my time frame, you will have a potty break at 10:45. Your bladder will comply.
That's it, absolutely.
Your brain, your everything. Everything
but
has to.
As is pointed out in the book, the kind of people this produces
mm-hmm.
is followers.
Mm-hmm.
Followers rather than leaders.
Yes.
And they let others make the decisions for them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting because we see it in teen behavior as well.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
Then the next thing is the permissive parent.
Yep.
And the permissive parent this is equally as bad.
Oh, yes.
This is the parent that lets anything go.
I will not squash my child's spirit.
No, but we would appreciate if you discipline them because they're driving the rest of us insane.
And we'll define discipline. We're not talking beat the heck out of them. But, you know, take them aside. Say, you know what? Nobody's going to want to hang out around you when you act like this.
Right. And so that's exactly what happens is it leads to kids that are selfish and act defiantly when they don't get their way. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, nobody wants to be around that.
Nope.
So then the third choice is the authoritative parent, somewhere in the middle between the two extremes. They value their child's autonomy and want the kid to experiment, to try different things, and to learn the consequences. But the most important thing is they spend time talking to their kids about the rules and why the rules exist, but they also maintain the rules in a positive and warm manner. These are the kinds of kids that end up confident, emotionally stable, and optimistic.
Yep.
And that's what we want.
And they're very capable.
Very capable. Mm-hmm. Absolutely very capable kids. And we see this in homeschooling. We see it all the time. We've had some absolutely incredible examples of kids who have come from an authoritative situation. And they show up on our doorstep and suddenly the freedom to be who they are and be accepted for who they are produces amazing results.
Sometimes
and those kids
it
blossom.
It takes a long time to see them come away from some of that. It's
well, because there's a lot of distrust, right? And they're distrustful of the fact that this new freedom might suddenly be yanked away from them. And the fact that they are currently being honored for who they are, that too might be yanked out from underneath of them. And suddenly it might go back to having to be graded and you're not as smart as the next guy and you're not meeting benchmarks and so on. But we've also seen the other situation. Again, this is what I really love about Phoenix and the foundation that we've provided for so many families is the fact that sometimes a permissive parent who doesn't have a lot of structure can come to Phoenix and by taking a few classes, by setting up a regular kind of schedule, by engaging a learning coach and getting their help to set boundaries, that same permissive parent can provide structure for that kid. And we see those kids really take off too because they needed something more. They needed some structure and some guidelines.
Well, you know, what we've said often is that, you know, what can happen here often is modeling different ways of learning, of educating, and of communicating. It's modeling, and it's just a community. And it's, you know, they say, what does it take? A village? Sometimes it takes a phoenix.
And I think that's true. I think that is very, very true, is that we all work together. We use the term, we are a community of learners. It is nothing around here to see a mom working with a group of kids. And when you ask or look a little deeper, you recognize, hey, wait a minute, that kid doesn't belong here. And that kid, wait a minute, that's not the same family. Hey, where'd you get all these kids? And the mom is sitting there working with them. Or a little kid wandered over and went, hey, that looks cool, Kent. And they were, sit down. You can learn too. And suddenly everybody's learning. And so, like I said, that is an amazing sight. And it's the way it should be.
Yeah. It's wonderful to see, you know. You see the older kids sitting with the younger kids. Maybe they have a new hobby they're doing. And the younger ones are kind of peering over their shoulder and dangling off the arm of the chair. And you know, they're just all hanging out. No one's saying, get away. You're not my friend.
Or I can't talk to you because you're not in my grade.
That's right. You're not in my grade.
That one I love.
I know.
It's a good thing we can talk to each other.
I don't know. I make exceptions. You're not really in my grade. You're way too young.
Yeah, well, okay. So a couple of the things that might get in the way, some of the barriers to really building trust and self-reliance. First one, making limiting assumptions about your kids. Have you ever done this where you've said, oh, you can't do that? And then guess what? They can. So be careful about putting limits on your children. I think it's important that we don't always step in and rescue them.
See this? I always struggled with this one. Best thing I ever did was learn to knit. It was a wonderful education tool because I would knit while they would do it so I couldn't hover. And then if they needed help, I'd be, well, wait a minute, I have to finish this row. And you work on it until I finish this row. And it gave them time, and I didn't jump to help.
Right.
It was wonderful.
Okay, so Jill is recommending everybody takes up knitting.
I do. Hey, it's good for math, too.
There you go. Mm-hmm. So I think another barrier here is being too controlling over every detail. Mm-hmm. And I have to laugh. My poor daughter, I hope she never listens to this podcast.
We know our kids don't.
Yay! Anyways, but when Megan was little, she was insistent on dressing herself. Okay. And she would pick pink pants and a blue jacket and purple this. And I'd be like, oh, no, because I had wanted to dress her so that she looked all cute and sort of doll-like. Mm-hmm. Eventually, I thought, come on, Diana, really? Mm-hmm. What difference does it make? She's learning how to dress herself, and this is really an important skill. So eventually, how I resolved the issue was much like you, where you use knitting as a tool. I went and bought a little button that said, I dressed myself today.
Ah, a disclaimer button.
Yeah. Well, she wore it very proudly because it was a badge mm-hmm. to her. I dressed myself today. Look what I did. Mm-hmm. I am an accomplished young person.
Yes.
And I wore, and I made her wear the button or gave her the button as exactly that, a disclaimer.
Oh, I wish I'd have thought of it. Perfect.
But again, the problem was not Megan's sense of style or whatever. It was mine. It was, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
So the there are two more points here that they make. One is imposing unrealistic standards.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I think that is a real problem for today's day and age. Mm-hmm. In the past, we recognized our kids' talents, mm-hmm. and they perhaps went to apprentice somewhere to mm-hmm. develop those skills and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we expect everybody to be good at everything.
Yes.
And it's not a realistic standard.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing is, and we were just talking about this today earlier, expecting a child to understand an adult's perspective.
Yeah, no.
You know, we've lived a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we learned things as we went.
Yes.
And the part that I find fascinating, how many times have you stood in your child's shoes mm-hmm. and then later picked up the phone and called your mom and apologized?
Yes. My mom gets this call. Hi, Mom. How are you today? I'm fine. And we'll chat for a while, and then she'll say something. I'll go, you're right. And then we'll be chatting some more, and she'll say, I'm going to do that. And she'll be like, wait a minute. I'm like, she goes, are you having one of those days? I'm like, yes, I've been wrong all week long. And I know I did this to you, and I just wanted you to hear. You're right. Your wisdom is appreciated.
Well, let's hope and trust in the process, Jill, that mm-hmm. our own children will come to understand that we weren't stupid.
Now,
we actually knew the odd thing.
Now and then.
Now and then.
Sometimes I am.
Okay, so what then? Builds self-confidence and reliance, self-reliance. I think a couple of things is checking in on your kids, right?
Yeah.
So checking, instead of controlling the details, we need to do things like, hey, it's minus 40 out there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is Calgary. It's possible, you know.
Yes.
It could be minus 40.
Today.
What do you need
mm-hmm.
to ensure you don't freeze to death?
I think I'm not going to wear my bathing suit today.
That's probably a good idea.
Yeah.
So, but allowing the kid to think about the things that they need.
And sometimes, you know, like I sometimes have to, you know, because you never want your child to be uncomfortable or wet or cold and all these things. But you know what? They get a certain age as well. If they go out, and you're not talking about locking them out of the door for 8 hours in minus 40 degrees, but you know, if they forget their jacket or a hoodie or they get wet, it's really not going to kill them to be uncomfortable. And next time, they'll think about it.
Exactly.
You know?
And I think it's important. I recall as a teenager going on a trip overseas with my group of teens there, and one of the girls had no idea how to run a washing machine.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother, she was 18 years old, and her mother had done her laundry
mm-hmm.
always.
Yes.
She had no idea even how a washing machine was supposed to work.
Yes.
And I just thought, wow, this is horrible. We are in a foreign country
uh-huh.
and dirty and filthy, and you have no way of getting clean clothes.
Yeah.
sad.
It is. And, you know, what about the ones who can't cook?
Yeah.
Our kids, fortunately, will never starve because they like to eat, they like to cook.
And nor will we.
And they know how to grocery shop, but some don't.
And I think this is the next point, where it talks about allowing kids to explore and to deal directly with the experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a huge difference between watching MasterChef on TV and actually being in the kitchen and having your chili burn. Or sticking a jalapeno in your eye.
Jalapeno finger.
That's it.
But, you know... Good learning moments, all of those.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I think you need to be encouraging and inviting of children. And I think when children feel invited into a situation, then they start considering the needs of others. And they learn to work in cooperation. I think it's interesting how studies have shown that homeschooling kids demonstrate far more cooperative behavior than kids raised in the public system.
Yes.
And yet one of the reasons why people talk about the need for public education is socialization.
Yes. Isn't that interesting?
I think it's very funny.
Yes,
okay,
yes.
But a final thing here is we need to both respect and celebrate.
Yep.
So celebrate small things. Celebrate accomplishment, remain positive, all those kinds of things. This builds optimistic children.
But I want to go on the other side of that. Don't just gush over every silly little thing. Children are not stupid. They know if you're sincere.
Absolutely.
You know, don't, every move they make is not poetry and magic. But when they do,
it's not.
I know. But when they do have a good moment, acknowledge it.
So I'd like to finish off here with a quote from Albert Einstein. And he talks about, I think the most important question facing humanity is the universe a friendly place? This is the first and most basic question all people must answer for themselves. But I think our children decide that the world is a friendly place if we make it so. If they can trust, if they can trust in us, and we can trust in their learning, and we can trust in the past, that kids all over the world for thousands of years have turned out to be fantastic human beings and contributed to the fabric of society, and they were homeschooled.
How weird.
I know. So I think those are things we can all work on and think about for this week coming up. Next week, we're going to explore the next chapter on page 31, and it talks about the nature of interests. And so this will be interesting. It talks a little bit about getting in the flow of things and finding out when is the right time to teach things. So the little quote here from Galileo is, "You cannot teach a man anything. You can only help him find it within himself." So next week we'll explore that a little more.
Good. I'll read the whole chapter next week.
As we hope you are reading the chapter along with us at home. Okay, well, this is Diana Stinn.
And Jill Mann.
And we're saying goodbye for right